You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Chat person, muckraker of the moment, Kara Swisher, has seemingly every power player in Hollywood, media, and tech on speed dial. Now, as she tangles with Elon Musk and churns out podcast, the ultimate insider is running her own show by Charlotte Klein, with photographs by Gillian Laub. Opening photo, Catitude, shows Kara Swisher with her cat. Kara Swisher's stare can make CEOs squirm. Lovely's is pretty good, too. Kara Swisher, rocking aviators, AirPods, and a Lesbians Who Tech sweatshirt, rolls into Vox Media's D.C. headquarters and gets right to work. Today's episode of On with Kara Swisher, a twice-weekly podcast that launched in September, is about the future of the Republican Party after the House Speaker free-for-all, and she's tapped CNN's Manu Raju and the Bulwark's Charlie Sykes to make sense of the mess. Once the guests come on camera, Swisher apologizes for wearing sunglasses, explaining that she forgot her prescription pair at home. "It's very dark Brandon," says Raju. "I had it before him," Swisher shoots back. "Let's be clear on that situation." Swisher, as an interviewer, shows little tolerance for bloviating. She gets to the point. About halfway through the episode, she calls for a lightning round of House Republicans, asking Sykes to tell us if the person is a true believer or a phony. Marjorie Taylor Greene. She is a conspiracy theorist, batshit crazy bigot, and anti-Semite, and for some reason that has made her a rock star in the Republican Party, says Sykes, a never-Trump-style conservative. And she's a believer. It's bullshit, but she believes in it. After wrapping up the podcast, her third taping that day, Swisher keeps up a rapid-fire patter with me. In the course of a few minutes, she bemoans the lack of entrepreneurial reporters, recalls a big fight with Roger Goodell after the NFL commissioner suggested her sons play football, and mentions talking the previous night with super agent Ari Emanuel about bull riding. But just like that, Swisher has to run. Not to CNN, where she's booked to appear that night, but for drinks with executives from CNBC. She recently declined to re-sign her contributor contract with the network because she felt constrained by its exclusivity rules, and the money wasn't enough to keep me there. Now they've come to talk to her again. "I always get approached by the networks," Swisher tells me, "and they just never," she lets out an exasperated sigh, "they never know what they want to make," which is not a problem she seems to have. Beyond On, Swisher, 60, also hosts Pivot, a twice-weekly podcast with brash NYU marketing professor Scott Galloway, is writing a memoir about her beat reporting days covering the dawn of the web, is working on a fictional TV show with another veteran Silicon Valley journalist, is advising Post News, a social platform she hopes will be a Twitter competitor, and is raising four kids, two of whom are toddlers. She has a coffee before bed every night, after midnight, Semaphore's Ben Smith text. This seems somehow emblematic to me, in a good way. Swisher, who is 5'2" but writes tall, as she likes to say, has carved a considerable niche for herself, cutting across television, the web, podcast, and social media, becoming the queen of all media, as veteran tech journalist Walt Mossberg puts it. The former Vox Media colleague is less charitable. She's always been searching for a way to make her platform even bigger, and she's done that, but it begins and ends with her. There's no legacy beyond that. Leaving legacy aside for the moment, Swisher has plowed a path through the media landscape alongside industry shifts, from reporting at a newspaper to blogging to co-founding successful websites and conferences to becoming a brand unto herself, part of a trend of elite journalists walking away from legacy outlets in pursuit of more freedom and, potentially, profits. Last year, she gave up a podcast and column at the New York Times, largely because, as she says, I don't need mama telling me what to do. And she stepped back from Code, the iconic tech conference she'd organized and hosted for the past 2 decades. It was like painting the same painting over and over again, she tells me, and I just wanted to make something else. On is the 6th podcast Swisher has hosted, but it's the first where she owns the IP and has complete editorial control. She's riffed on Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg while expanding her aperture well beyond Silicon Valley, interviewing the likes of Darren Star and Gina Davis, and exploring topics ranging from comedy to death. Swisher's betting there's an audience willing to turn to her for more than just expertise on tech moguldom. I mentor a lot of people, and almost every single one of them is worried about losing their place if they step out of line. And I'm like, the only way you get higher is if you step out of line, Swisher tells me. That's the only way. Seriously. Unless you're untalented, and then you should stay in line. On a Monday afternoon in January, Swisher's house is chaotic, but the good kind, the kind you find in a place where life is happening. Toys are strewn everywhere, and a baby is laughing and sometimes crying, and the sink is running in the kitchen, where the golden child, as Swisher's 3-year-old daughter is commonly referred to on her podcast, is about to have a snack. There's lots of talk of Elsa cheese, which is string cheese that Disney has branded with Frozen characters. The golden child crawls up onto the counter where, at the opposite end, Swisher and her wife, the journalist Amanda Katz, are catching up on each other's day. How was the Scaramucci thing? Who won? Katz asks, referring to a public debate Swisher did that morning with financier Anthony Scaramucci on whether Elon Musk, whom Swisher has known and covered since the 90s, is killing Twitter. I did, obviously, says Swisher. I said he is, and it's killing Elon more than he's killing it. And then Pivot was good, Swisher says. Scott made at least 14 prostitute jokes. Despite having a mini-stroke a decade back, Swisher famously does not like taking time off and works around the clock. In December, she had heart surgery, and she was working the day before and the day after. That's not an exaggeration, Galloway tells me. When I ask Swisher how the surgery went, she replies, good, obviously. Her turbocharged work ethic could be traced in part to tragedy early in life. When she was 5, her father died suddenly at 34 of complications from a brain aneurysm. Fresh out of the Navy and with 3 kids, he'd just purchased his first house and landed a gig as the head of anesthesia at the Brooklyn Jewish Hospital. He thought he was headed for the big time. He just died, fell over one day, and that has informed everything I've done. I'm like, I don't have time for this, says Swisher, adding, you don't have time either. Nobody has time. Swisher's mother remarried soon after, to a cruel man whom Swisher couldn't say enough bad things about, but admits was a canny engineer. When Swisher was in 6th grade, they moved from Long Island to Princeton, New Jersey, for his work, and when the rest of the family moved to California a few years later, Swisher stayed behind. I was like, I'm the yearbook editor. I have a boyfriend, F you, she recalls. I lived with friends and finished my senior year by myself pretty much. Swisher knew she was gay from age 4, but didn't have a girlfriend until college. At Georgetown School of Foreign Service, she studied propaganda, an education that shaped her view of misinformation and Donald Trump's manipulation of the media. I think I was one of the first to say there's real damage going on here, and we have to start paying attention to it, Swisher says. You have to be able to look at that and see what they're doing, even if you decry it and hate it. I was always interested in the moving of the Overton window. Swisher wanted to follow her father into the military. I thought I might go into the CIA, she says, but that would have required her to lie about being gay. I didn't even try. During college, she worked as a stringer for the Washington Post after complaining to then-Metro editor Larry Kramer about a sloppy story they'd published on a Georgetown event. Years later, after stints at Columbia Journalism School, a waste of money that she wished she'd invested in Apple stock instead, the Washington City Paper and the political chat fest, the McLaughlin Group, whose host, the late John McLaughlin, she later testified against in a sexual harassment case, she returned to the Post, working her way up from style news aide to reporter on the local retail beat. The Post is where I significantly started to use technology, says Swisher, recalling the K-Pro computer she used to lug around the office. Swisher put herself on the map nationally at the Post while covering the defining dot-com saga of the 90s, AOL and its eventual disastrous merger with Time Warner. Kara always had this larger-than-life personality. I remember her as short, feisty, the kind of person who sets the room alive, recalls the Post David Ignatius, who was business editor when Swisher was writing for the section. She was a star. We knew we couldn't hold her. She left to write her first of two books on AOL, meeting Mossberg along the way. He recommended her for a job at the Wall Street Journal, where in 2003 the duo launched the All Things D Conference, a live journalism extravaganza featuring the biggest names in tech. It was at this conference in 2007 that Bill Gates and Steve Jobs took the stage together in an historic joint interview, and a few years later, where Zuckerberg broke into a profuse sweat amid questions about Facebook privacy. Kara's never ad hominem. She might be snarky, but she doesn't attack people. She attacks their actions and their ideas, Mossberg tells me. People feel that her interviews can elevate them, and sometimes it can hurt them, but that it's worth the price of admission, says veteran executive producer Tommy Haddad. A recent example is CNN chief executive Chris Licht, who, to put it mildly, got off to a rough start. It was strategic for Licht to give his first extensive interview to Swisher, a source close to the CNN chief acknowledges. As Swisher had the credibility to help reshape the narrative, but also would give the impression that Chris is pretty fearless, because she's a tough interviewer. The success of the conference convinced Dow Jones to let Mossberg and Swisher start the All Things D blog. They left in 2013 to start their own venture, for which they'd raised $10 million in funding, taking the All Things D staff with them and trying unsuccessfully to take the brand too. But journal owner Rupert Murdoch, she says, wanted $10 million for the URL. I wrote them back. I said, I can buy FU Rupert for $10. So All Things D became Recode, and the D Conference became the Code Conference. About a year and a half later, Vox Media purchased Recode in an all-stock deal. CEO Jim Bankoff, who first encountered Swisher as an AOL executive on the other end of one of her reporting calls, basically let her do whatever she wanted at Vox Media. Not long after the sale, Swisher stopped running Recode. I hate managing, she says, and started the Recode Decode podcast. What really sold her on podcasting was the emotional attachment listeners felt to her as a host. Part of what makes Swisher so compelling is her ability to move between the personal and the work with ease, says New York Times CEO Meredith Kopit-Levien. Swisher noticed that her geek guy audience began to expand after venturing into podcasting, such as when four women of color, all entrepreneurs, approached her on the Muni in San Francisco. Kara, it's you. I can't believe it. I'm like, this is not my effing demo, Swisher remembers. More recently, a firefighter made a 180 in the street in New York to take a selfie with her, she recalls. He's like, I love you. I knew these NFTs were bullshit. Thank you for explaining it to me. She signed off as host of Recode Decode in July 2020, 5 years and more than 500 interviews later. By then, she'd started Pivot. The dynamic is Galloway as provocateur and Swisher reeling him in. Also in 2020, Pivot became part of New York Magazine, which Vox Media had acquired a year earlier. Despite the New York association, Swisher, who has two teenage sons with her first wife, former Google executive Megan Smith, is living in D.C. again. For most of our conversation at her home, she wears her signature aviator sunglasses until it's dark enough that she gets up to turn on a lamp. She has an eye condition that causes sensitivity to light. The aviators are a brand thing. The dark glasses are not, she explains. As we're talking, we are occasionally interrupted by other pieces of Swisher's life popping through the doorway. The cat, cats, and the golden child, who comes in to ask Swisher to help her put the shoe back on her Barbie. Fiddling with a plastic shoe, Swisher tells her daughter, "Honey, I never played with Barbies." Swisher tells me she did an interview with the CEO of Mattel and told him she hated Barbie. Afterward, he sent her a box of them. I let her keep one, and I gave the rest to charity. The golden child leaves the doll on the table in front of Swisher, who proceeds for the next hour to stroke Barbie's hair while we talk. The word brand, it makes you feel like you're a jar of peanut butter, says Swisher, recalling how people used to lodge it as an insult. I'm making something that has my name on it, and because of the new tools available to us through the internet, we can now get our voice out there in ways we couldn't, she says. I think I was one of the first to say that to people. And obviously, the people who run these places do not like that message. When I left the Journal, everyone suddenly was like, you can leave? They were shocked, she whispers. I was like, you can leave. I'm trying to teach you that, right? Swisher says to her daughter, who nods. Yeah, you're going to do what you want to do. Another nod. Yeah, good. You're going to watch Frozen all the time is what you're going to do. Swisher, lowering her voice, tells me, it's heroin. I texted Bob Iger. I'm like, stop. You put it on cheese. What the F? When I ask Swisher whether the success of Pivot has given her the freedom to turn down or leave other projects, she practically snorts. I'll walk away from anything, she says. I always feel like I can make something else. Case in point, the New York Times, where Swisher landed an opinion column in 2018. Then came Sway, a twice-weekly podcast about power that was meant to be a Terry Gross-type show. Hillary Clinton and Jane Goodall were early guests, but changed direction over time as it became more reactive to news. Some episodes made a splash, like one in the aftermath of the January 6th insurrection, in which Swisher pressed Parler CEO John Matz on the right-wing social media platform's role. Apple cited his comments on Sway in its decision to remove Parler from its app store. Matz was fired a month later. But then Swisher started to get itchy, as she puts it, particularly with the column, which she says can become a live coffin for people who stay too long. I think most people have 40 good columns in them. And there was tumult at Sway. 6 people left the Times after about a year or less of working on the show. It was totally known across the opinion audio department that this was a nightmare show to work for, says one Times staffer, who, along with 3 former opinion audio staffers, points to impossible deadlines and poor management. There were months and months of interventions and people trying to fix it, the staffer says. When I ask Swisher how she felt she was as a manager on Sway, she says she wasn't one. She was talent. Nobody reported directly to me, says Swisher. I didn't hire them. I didn't fire them. I didn't do their reviews or anything like that. I wasn't involved in anybody's review, unfortunately. As for the turnover, she says, I think it was that they didn't hire the right people in the first place, because I do news. I point out that Sway was a product of the opinion side of Times Audio, not its news division, which she dismisses as an irrelevant distinction. When something happens, I want to do it right away. They just didn't want to move that way. I totally get it. I completely respect it. But I just didn't want to do the slower show. I wanted to do the fast burn show, and so it was a real struggle. Swisher started hosting conversations on Twitter Spaces. I was making something else. When I have four children, four podcasts a week, a column, what does that say to you? I'm not making what I want to make. She was also chafing against the Times bureaucracy. I just wanted to make what I wanted to make, and I didn't want to ask 86 people. They're all really smart. They just aren't me. New York Times opinion editor Kathleen Kingsbury applauded Swisher's unmistakable voice and says the section was grateful for her 4 years of reporting and commentary for us. As Swisher was getting increasingly restless at the Times, she was considering opportunities elsewhere, including the Washington Post, which was talking to her about a role spanning podcast, live events, and columns. They wanted to bring in a star, and they just didn't want to pay, says Swisher. She went furthest down the road with CNN, which wanted her to host a show on CNN Plus and was offering millions of dollars, according to Swisher. Galloway had already signed his own deal to host a program on the forthcoming streaming service, but she was wary given the impending Warner Brothers Discovery merger. They're going to have to cut something big. And guess what's big and stupid? That, she said of CNN Plus, which Discovery quickly killed off. Swisher wanted to make a different type of interview show, less formal than Sway and more about me, Swisher says. I just didn't think I could make it there. The audience was different. They weren't in on the joke. Over at New York, editor-in-chief David Haskell was on the same page. You know, I listened to it. I was sometimes jealous of it, he says of Sway. And there were ways in which I also thought we might be a better home for her. Once she decided to leave, Swisher first told Levian, the Times CEO, I didn't go to the editorial people. I knew they'd be hurt. They have a vision of nobody leaves the Times. But she got it right away, says Swisher. It was good to have her at the Times for the stretch we had her, and it makes sense to me why she moved on, says Levian, describing Swisher as a force in the industry. Over lunch at a Japanese restaurant in Cathedral Heights, I ask Swisher how much of her decision to leave the Times had to do with ownership. A lot, she says, between bites of salmon teriyaki. What was happening at the time is I find out that all the stuff at the Journal, the All Things D stuff, disappeared from the Internet, says Swisher. They were so careless with my stuff, she says. I've done 1,000 or more interviews. I own none of them. Meanwhile, there she was at the Times, growing something else that wasn't hers. I also wanted a piece of the revenue again, and the Times is not going to do that, sorry to tell you, she says. I was working at a discount at the New York Times for what I make. Next photo, house party. Honey, I never played with Barbies, Swisher tells her daughter. She let her keep one from a box sent over by Mattel's CEO. As Benkoff was preparing to launch The Verge in 2011, he decided to break the news in a co-exclusive with Swisher at All Things D and the late David Carr at The Times. She made it very clear to me that if I were to burn her, in other words, hold up information from her that Carr was getting, there would be repercussions, Benkoff recalled, laughing. I'm not exactly sure what those repercussions would be, but I knew then and I know now that you keep your word with Kara. I used to be so aggressive about that stuff. Not anymore. I don't care, Swisher tells me when I ask her about this story. Scoops don't matter anymore because they're so ephemeral, she says. Still, she bristles at the idea that she's still not reporting. I do reporting all the time, she tells me. It manifests itself in my interviews, says Swisher. I'm doing reporting analysis now. I am not doing punditry. Even if she's toned down her reporting style, she's still seen as someone not to cross. Multiple people wouldn't speak to me for this story because they reminded me Swisher is a powerful person. She's willing to get into the brawl with me, Emmanuel, the Endeavor CEO, told me, likening his and Swisher's back and forths to the Friday night dinners at my house that I used to have. You had to come with a strong argument and points of view, and willing to throw blows and take blows. Emmanuel met Swisher more than a decade ago at a Silicon Valley gathering. She's somebody that, when I have a question about their point of view, and I trust their point of view, I'll pick up the phone and say, what's your take on this? Swisher sees her role now less as breaking news about tech companies than interpreting the words and actions of the industry titans she knows very well. Take Musk, for example. They're not on speaking terms. He recently called her an asshole in an email. And yet Swisher has still managed to position herself as the go-to Elon expert. She's even featured herself as the guest for an On episode titled Elon Musk, Somebody That I Used to Know. Swisher's executive producer and on-air sidekick, Naima Raza, conducted the interview. Swisher similarly served as interviewee on a recent Zuckerberg episode, and as with Musk, takes on the role of tech industry conscience. Part of the power of her podcast is there's a sense of somebody who has been here the whole time and is kind of fed up, says tech journalist Casey Newton, who considers Swisher a mentor as well as a landlord. He rents her guest cottage in San Francisco. The often blurry line between Swisher the insider and Swisher the reporter is precisely her appeal. Kara sort of in constant text conversation with half the planet, and it's a thrill to realize that that's what's buzzing in your pocket, says Haskell. I got my own glimpse of this over the course of reporting this piece, as I'd get random text from Swisher at all hours, weighing in on the media topic du jour, and once accidentally roping me into a group chat with her agents. Those who socialize with her in the Capitol describe her in a perpetual state of gathering string. She knows everybody, and she gets invited everywhere because she's fun, says legendary Washington journalist and host Sally Quinn, whose late husband Ben Bradley hired Swisher to the Post. She also has an incredible bullshit detector, which is always helpful in Washington, Quinn adds. Swisher is in the middle of writing her memoir about covering the early days of the Internet. It's taking her a while, because in addition to all these children, jobs, and heart surgeries, she tells me, I don't like the people I'm writing about anymore. A few weeks later, at an absurdly late hour, she texted that she just finished her chapter on Jeff Bezos. Tomorrow, Rupert, she added. As part of a two-book deal, Swisher also hopes to write a book with her brother, the Dr. Jeffrey Swisher, about the science of living forever. At the moment, she's also working on a documentary about AOL with Left Right Productions. It's a great concept, and I'm the only one who can help them, and a scripted show about tech with Bloomberg's Brad Stone, who is doing the screenwriting. They have a showrunner, so we'll see if we sell it, says Swisher. She's also been advising Post News, a social network founded by former Waze CEO Noam Barden, and has been encouraging people to join it on Twitter. I would like a viable competitor to Twitter by an entrepreneur I respect, Swisher says. I hate that there's one Twitter. Swisher says she tries to structure her deals, where I get a piece of it for my success. For Pivot, she received Vox Media stock that can be converted to cash after 4 years. With Own, She owns the IP, has a minimum salary, and they share the revenue after cost. I think reporters are super uncomfortable talking about money, and I'm not at all, she said. I really hate that journalists don't understand business. If you don't understand the economics of what's happening, you're effed. She clearly, through her journalism, understood not only the value but the power of intellectual property while covering what others were doing in that space. Disney CEO Bob Iger, who has bantered with Swisher both offstage and on for years, tells me. There she was, with a front-row seat to the mining of great intellectual property, using technology, really, as a means of creating value, he says, adding that Swisher, in effect, turned the results of her own reporting on herself. In February 2022, Galloway and Swisher held the inaugural Pivot Conference, in which they both have an ownership stake. It was not a financial success. It was very expensive to put on, Galloway tells me. They've held other live Pivot events, including in Germany and London in January, but are still figuring out what's next. About half of Pivot's audience is Gen Z or Millennial, with more than 70% in the 18 to 49 age bracket, according to a Vox Media spokesperson. One idea is going to business schools, where Swisher says Pivot has a crazy fan base, and creating some sort of networking occasion. Something else besides people sitting in an effing ballroom, she says. Even with so many projects swirling in the present, Swisher has an eye toward posterity. In history, they're going to watch that Gates and Jobs interview. 100 years from now, that's how we got them to do it, really, she told me. They're going to watch all these interviews. It's like you had Thomas Edison, and I challenged him. Rather than what grows up around them, the mythology, you'll be able to hear them being interviewed by someone who was good at interviewing. The Kingdom of Prep. Before there was Olympia Gayot, before there was Jenna Lyons, there was Emily Senator, the enigmatic J. Crew co-founder, whose own idea of rumpled cool made the fledgling fashion brand and its catalog take off, by Maggie Bullock. Opening photos, selling the dream, J. Crew became an enviable lifestyle brand by presenting well-made basics as low-key luxury. And catalog pages are pictured here. When you think of J. Crew, you probably picture Jenna Lyons, the larger-than-life high-fashion persona whose image became synonymous with the brand. If you are a person who has bothered to give the matter of J. Crew's identity any thought, that is. 6 years after departing the role, Lyons' image will soon loom even larger as a member of the revamped cast of The Real Housewives of New York City. The generation currently coming of shopping age might solely associate it with its current head of women's design, millennial social media darling Olympia Gayot. But the original human embodiment of J. Crew, though she will surely be uncomfortable to see it put in these terms, was a woman whom even constant J. Crew shoppers have never heard of. Today, she lives deep under the radar at her minimalist Connecticut manse, married to a co-founder of Nantucket Nectars and going by her married name, Emily Scott. But at the dawn of J. Crew, she was Emily Senator. There was no daddy's little girl about Emily. In January 1983, when she first walked into the offices of the fledgling catalog company her father, Arthur Senator, had just founded, Emily was 21, a month out of college, completely green. The first J. Crew catalog had just shipped out to 10,000 would-be preps that month. Within its first week, the new bank of telephone operators at the company headquarters in Garfield, New Jersey, found themselves inundated. The customer response was astounding, an early marketing head told me. The operation Emily walked into was all hands on deck, too small to have anything like departments for a newbie to work her way up through. She didn't flounce in with a sense of ownership, but she was no mere assistant either. Emily was innately discerning, had an eye for style, a hand for quality, an instinct, at a time when the company identity was still wet clay for what was and wasn't J. Crew. And she was more than willing to speak her mind. Some describe this quality appreciatively, others not so much. Young Emily was either very smart, with every reason to be as confident as she appeared, or boldly entitled, with no one to stand in her way. She presumed herself a leader of rank, recalls an early executive, and she took it, was good at it, and it was never challenged. This new brand, which had been in the works for some 2 years before the catalog launched, was not anybody's passion project. It was not driven by its founder's particular love for the Ivy League look. Emily's father had inherited from his father a profitable down-market mail-order company, Popular Club Plan. Arthur had grown the family firm to a size that was likely beyond his dad's wildest dreams, but he knew the company was never going to crack the big leagues. This new offshoot, J. Crew, was a calculated bid at an emerging market, the collegiate prep, whose ilk was driving early 80s pop culture. Kids who dug Ralph Lauren's hit look, but couldn't quite swing Lauren's price point. Debuting as a watered-down Ralph Lauren served its purpose. Just by striking upon affordable prep at the right time, J. Crew struck a small tendril of nerve fiber in the culture and established a crucial genetic code: clean-cut, sporty, up-tempo American style. While industry wisdom dictated that a brand new catalog from a company no one had ever heard of had to be prepared to spend 2.5 years in the red, J.Crew broke even within roughly 18 months. By 1984, it was a startup galloping ahead. But aesthetically, the early J.Crew catalog, version 1.0, if you will, wasn't all that different from Land's End, the prairie home companion of catalogs. The cute couples J.Crew featured were as wistful as those on the cover of romance novels, playful shoots of models horsing around on the dock of some collegiate boathouse because Crew had a whiff of fromage. J.Crew 1.0 was still leagues away from the catalog that would, a few years hence, become a cultural phenomenon, even an identity, so J.Crew. That one, the J.Crew for which early fans still harbor intense nostalgia, was 2.0, Emily's J.Crew. Officially, what Emily brought to the table in 1983 was a freshly minted marketing degree from the University of Denver. But she had something more ephemeral, too. Something most of her father's early hires sorely lacked. First-hand knowledge of the young, outdoorsy, preppy life that J.Crew aimed to embody. To most of her new colleagues, All-American Youth was primarily a demo, a promising target audience. But to Emily, this was no focus-grouped lifestyle. It was her own generation, to a degree, her world. The night Tierney Gifford Horn met Emily in 1984, the two women were officially on a double date in a Manhattan hotspot. But they paid their dates no mind. Instead, Emily turned the evening into a fact-finding mission. She seemed to want to know everything about Horn's job as a fashion assistant at Vogue. How did the shoots work? How was the styling put together? Horn was fascinated by Emily and told her everything, but she never guessed what Emily had in mind. She was stunned when, bright and early the next morning, Emily called her at the magazine. Would Horn come work for J.Crew? Poaching from Vogue, period, took chutzpah. Attempting it at a time when high and low fashion did not mix, and catalog brands were strictly steerage class. Sorry, J.Who? Well, that gives you a sense of the scope of Emily's ambitions. When Horn told her magazine colleagues about the job offer, they practically put out an APB. You don't leave Vogue for a startup catalog in New Jersey. Was she nuts? Next photo, American Idol. Tierney Horn, one of Emily Senator's early recruits, spent childhood summers in Amagansett, an ethos Emily was keen to capture. But there was something about Emily. It was partially her beauty. She was a classic Allie McGraw type, tall, slim, athletic, with ramrod straight posture, espresso dark hair, that even then, at the height of the white rain big hair era, was cut in a sleek, chin-length bob, and skin that appeared perpetually fresh scrubbed. The kind of woman who looks stunning in a plain men's button-down shirt. But it was more than that. To Horn, who was just a few years her junior, Emily seemed so adult. She had a stillness, a formality, a complete lack of feminine affectation. It was hard to imagine something as frivolous as a giggle escaping her lips. So there was all that. And then there was J.Crew itself, this intriguing blank slate. Horn said yes. But when she arrived for her first day of work, fresh from the C&B scene offices of Condé Nast, the warnings of her Vogue sisters rang in her head. Seriously, was she nuts? In its former life, the popular Club Plan building in Garfield had been a two-guys discount store. Picture a low-rent Sears, a squat, flat, beige box, mired in acres of flat black parking lot. In the front of its fluorescent-lit space, wide as a bowling alley, sat row after row of women in polyester slacks, taking payments and orders for popular Club Plan. Way back in a corner sat the tiny operation that was J.Crew. It wasn't just the environs. At first, Horn wasn't sure what she'd been brought here to do. Lots of people who later came to work at J. Crew did so for the very reason Horn just had, largely because there was something about Emily. I spoke with dozens of people who had been hired by her and asked each, what was her vision exactly? What did she tell you she wanted to do? Most couldn't quite say. She had a sixth sense for people who got it and aggressively pursued talent. Horn was one of many who noted that Emily saw something in me that I did not see in myself. And once she brought in a new hire, the right one somehow discerned the vision, got on board, and served Emily loyally. The wrong ones found themselves spit out of a rapidly revolving door. In fact, what Emily wanted was to make a catalog that didn't feel like a catalog, one with images as beautiful as those in fashion magazines, images that could breathe fantasy into everyday basic clothes. And somehow, Emily had divined over a double date that Horn, at 20, came equipped with an internal slideshow full of exactly the kind of images that would take J. Crew in that direction. When I first spoke with Horn, she told me about childhood summers spent in the Long Island beach town of Amagansett, at a time when the Hamptons were not yet the Hamptons. Some mornings, her parents would wake up the children at 5 a.m., grab fishing poles and a frying pan, and head to the beach to catch fresh snapper. They'd fry it up on the spot with eggs and breakfast in their swimsuits. When she first described this scene, it sounded so cinematic. I figured it had to be partially manufactured, or at the very least gilded. But the next day, she emailed a scan of a white-edged family photo with 1966 scrawled on one corner in Sharpie, a family of five perched on a rock outcropping before an expanse of deep blue water. A crisp white sail juts up in the background. In the foreground, two slim parents, three kids, all dressed in shades of madras, with a silver frying pan glinting on a portable barbecue at their feet. This was exactly the slice of Americana that would soon underpin J. Crew. Images that wafted happiness and freedom, but also, gently and without spritzing anybody straight in the face with it, privilege. J. Crew was not the first to pioneer what would soon be called lifestyle photography. Far from it. By the time J. Crew rolled around, Lauren had already changed the game, with lavish campaigns that depicted his town and country garb in situ, on the yachts, golf greens, and sun-dappled verandas upon which the East Coast elite who inspired the look might lounge. These ads papered dorm room walls. People knew Lauren's models' names. They wondered whether Lauren's Adonis, Burton, Buzzy, Kerbox, and the aquamarine-eyed, patrician-looking Jane Gill were married in real life. But it's also true that the freshness of the Ralph Lauren look, so new when it took off in the late 70s, had begun to rub off. Once that happened, you had to admit, his models did look a little morose. They wore Amelia Earhart-style goggles behind the wheel of their vintage Rolls. But the car was always in park. Why weren't they having any fun? This made for an ideal jumping-off point for J. Crew. There was space for a brand that was not just more affordable, but also more fun, more welcoming, more real. Next photos, Reality Hunger. 1994 J. Crew catalogs featuring Emily's signature candid style, and Emily photographed at home in 1999. With J. Crew growing exponentially, the shoestring budget days of its earliest catalogs, loading a camper van with models and assistants and driving down to the UPenn Boathouse, were done. Emily okayed shoots in San Francisco, Newport, Harbor Island. By 1985, when photographer Kurt Marcus released After Barbed Wire, Cowboys of Our Time, featuring his black-and-white shots of cowpokes in Nevada and Texas. All Horn had to do was bring the book to Emily. We have to do this. Done. On a standard catalog shoot, one day might yield a total of 8 shots, maybe 10 if you were fast. To eke out more, Horn began styling a whole group of models in layers they could peel off as the day went on. I'd put on a t-shirt, then a polo shirt, then a chambray, then a jacket, she says. I'd layer the shit out of everybody, and then we'd give them a task. Okay, make pancakes over an open fire. So there you've got your jacket photo. The heavily layered 80s J. Crew look that became both revered and eventually joked about on non-waifs, 4 shirts was not the most flattering look. Started out as a practicality. Fewer outfit changes. Throw off the jacket, on to the next. Horn and her team made the clothes look lived in. They tossed fresh-pressed samples in the wash, sometimes repeatedly, until they looked properly aged. Dunked the belts in water, stomped the boots in puddles. Horn scoured prop houses and rental companies for the perfectly seasoned station wagon, a gross of surfboards, a litter of puppies, and all the flotsam and jetsam of the having it life. Dainty tea sets, Adirondack chairs, backgammon boards, stacks of Western blankets. She borrowed vintage luggage from T. Anthony, antique watches from Upper East Side jewelers. Shooting things that weren't for sale? This was how magazines worked, not catalogs. Their other secret? Motion. J. Crew models ice skated in the Adirondacks, picnicked in the Hamptons, skied in Deer Valley. They shimmied up the mast of a sailboat, strapped a Christmas tree to the roof of the family wagoneer, raced along a train platform, bags in hand, en route from someplace good to someplace even better. All that activity kept them from looking like catalog people. Those cardboard cutouts who existed solely to sell you things. If a model looked stiff, well, throw her on a bike. Hand her a picnic basket. Assign her a boyfriend with whom to play an endlessly thrilling game of tag. Give the boyfriend some shaving cream and a razor. This guy is shaving on the beach in his swim trunks. Just go with it. They had this incredible technique, which I absolutely loved, says photographer Tierney Giron. Her first J. Crew shoot in the early days of her career was in St. Bart, with a group of 10 or 15 models. Giron prefers to work like a film director. I create a lot of chaos, so the models aren't really paying attention to the camera, she says. And to her amazement, that's just how J. Crew was working. Huge crews, big productions, like a film scene. And it was all about feeling good. Back at the office, the litmus test of a great J. Crew picture was, does it feel real? Could it pass for a snapshot? By the 90s, this basic rule, no fakery, would be honed to a fine art. One catalog editor I spoke with recalled reviewing the art from each new shoot as a sort of game. The staff would gather in a dark, tiny photo editing room, sitting on the floor or perched on Formica countertops, as the photo editor clicked through a slideshow. Art was still shot on film and reviewed as slides. We'd all call out, fake smile, too modelly, says the editor, or most damning, tee-hee. This called out cliche, hand-over-mouth giggles. J. Crew girls didn't tee-hee. They laughed. Of course, these non-catalog models needed clothes to sell. Let's rewind back to 1984. For its first couple of years, J. Crew had no design team. Merchants ordered mostly existing standards from private label manufacturers, customized the color or maybe the buttons, and slapped a J. Crew label on them. Nothing to sniff at. This was standard operating procedure for many smaller companies. Emily elevated the product range as best she could, mostly by bringing in things to copy, sometimes as an outright knockoff, more often to match a hue or mimic a detail. Emily's finds would be shipped off to a faraway factory and return as J. Crew product. But the copycat game can get dicey. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.